Welcome, everybody, to an all-new comedy at the Carlson Cast. Get your information at carlsoncast.com. Today's special guest, it's episode number 92, Mr. Joe DeRosa. Now your host, he's a little tired this week. He's been spending the whole week shopping Pizza Hut closeout sales. It's Mr. Vinny Paulino. Because they're going out of business.
Pizza Hut's going out of business?
Well, the restaurants
are closing. They're closing a bunch of stores.
What?
So it's pretty much takeout only from now on.
They're closing like 700 stores, but they have like 7,000, so...
Yeah.
I know, it's a national...
How am I supposed to do a show now? when you lay that on my lap?
I can't just go to Gates and sit in a Pizza Hut and enjoy pizza with my family anymore?
They got the salad bars still!
Oh,
the
no.
Pizza Hut buffet!
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
Being in Gates?
Going to Gates, for one thing.
Can you imagine going to Gates for anything?
If you're going to Gates, you might as well go to Pizza Hut, I guess.
That's the only thing there. It's all they've got. That's,
I mean, what else would you do?
We apologize to the lovely people of Gates.
They're not lovely.
They're strong people.
The three lovely people that are currently traveling through Gates. Yeah.
Who have the capacity to listen to this show.
Yes, absolutely. Ouch.
I blame myself.
Okay, so if you're living in Gates, I'm so sorry for your loss. I don't know how else to start this. Welcome to the Comedy at the Carlson Cast. That was heavy. That was heavy for me. Joe DeRosa is going to be here, ladies and gentlemen. You may know him as a stand-up comic with, I believe, 4 full-hour comedy albums out. New specials out. An actor, podcaster. Podcasting before podcasting was cool.
Yeah.
And all-around good guy, Mr. Joe DeRosa, will be joining us in just a few minutes. We're very excited about that. I'm just so devastated to hear about Pizza Hut.
I've thrown the entire episode.
Yeah, like my heart hurts.
Maybe we'll just come back
next
week.
Maybe it's the Pizza Hut. Maybe this is a good thing. Yeah. That aching feeling might go away. It
might be the pizza.
The aching, heavy feeling in my chest. Very excited about that. It's going to be a very good show. If you would like to ask Joe DeRosa a question, you can text them in 585-484-0265. Also, thank you for listening. We appreciate you. We had a record number of downloads last week, so we really appreciate that. You're a good friend. You're a good friend.
Except you. And you know who I'm talking to.
So, Brian, do you know one of the rules of radio now that I learned from my friend Pauly G?
What's that?
I learned that when you talk to the audience, you have to talk to just, like, their one person. You can't just say, like, the way, Mark Maron opens up his podcast. He's like, hey, what the effers?
Yeah.
Like, we do Carlson Casters. Hey, Carlson Casters. We shouldn't do that. We have to pretend that there's just one person listening.
Which one?
That's the problem. We have to decide who this one person we're talking to is.
Bill and Gates.
We're talking to.
Ah, we lost it!
Damn it.
We have to figure out who that one person that we're talking
of the
to
three,
is.
So if you're one of the three people listening, it could be you.
It could be
could
you.
Be you.
We could be talking to you right now.
Statistically, it's likely.
It's there's a you know there's about a 40% chance it's you.
You guys can make jokes about nobody watching or listening, but you'd be very wrong.
No, a lot of people do watch it.
You know what? This week, we had 1,100 downloads from one particular place. This is not all we had. I'm just saying. We had 1,100 downloads from Wichita, Kansas, for some reason.
Wichita?
Wow. So I'm assuming there's a family in Wichita that's really big Brian Ball fans.
Yeah, I know
we're huge in Wichita.
You know one guy in Wichita?
Yeah.
Is that the guy we're talking to?
It could be,
what's his name?
Doug.
Doug in Wichita.
Hey, Doug in Wichita.
The Pizza Hut there closed us, so they need something to do.
Okay, so
he also has like 1.5 million Twitter followers, so he's probably YouTube followers, so we should probably be nice to him.
Doug.
Hey, Doug.
We're dedicating this episode to you, Doug. We'll be back with Joe DeRosa right after these words about upcoming shows here at Comedy at the Carlson. Which, if you live in Wichita, Doug, I'm sorry you're probably not going to be able to make the shows tonight, but we got some big ones coming up. You might be able to catch. Here's the list.
Hello, everybody. Lots of really cool shows coming up here at Comedy at the Carlson. Fall's getting in the air. We're getting all out into the fall season. We have Joe DeRosa this very weekend.
We're going to talk to him in a minute.
Yes. And we have Thea Vidal, August 15th through 17th. We always like talking to her.
One of our favorite guests.
Yes. Pete Davidson, One Night Only on August 17th. And we have Kevin Farley, August 22nd to the 24th.
That's him, all right.
Yep. And September 5th through 7th, Ron Funches. I hear there's an awesome host on that show. Harlan Williams, September 12th through the 14th. And September 19th to 21st, Marlon Wayans. We just announced that one.
Yeah, it's a new one.
Yeah. Doug Stanhope, One Night Only on September 24th. Awesome jacket. And Marcella Aguello, September 26th to the 28th. Mike Vecchione, October 10th through the 12th. What are you doing to me with these names? Sashira Zameda, October 17th through the 19th. Rocky Laporte, November 1st through the 2nd. And the one and only Bobby Slayton, November 7th through the 9th. I didn't know about that one. That's awesome. He's coming back.
We dug him up.
Gary Goldman, November 14th through the 16th. And November 21st through the 23rd, Vicky Barbalak.
Ah!
And the one and only Dr. Dirty John Valby on Thanksgiving Eve. Pete Corioli, December 12th
Pete
through
the Corelli,
14th.
Pete Corelli, you idiot.
Corelli, what did I say?
December
Corioli?
12th through the 14th. Yeah. Come on out to Comedy at the Carlson. We'll make you laugh harder than Brian. See you at a show. We are back. Joining us in studio is our headliner this weekend at Comedy at the Carlson, the incomparable Mr. Joe DeRosa. Hey, Joe.
Hi.
Woo! This is what it sounds like when two guys clap for you, man.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Doesn't sound much different when there's a full room. Kidding.
This is a weird start to a show.
Why?
I don't know. Just a weird morning. I got to ask you this question, just out of the gate. What's the worst question you've ever had on an interview? What's the dumbest thing anybody's ever started?
Probably this question.
Yeah. I got them. It's softball, Joe.
No,
softball.
Dumbest. No, no, no. Honestly, the dumbest, the worst question I ever got was I was doing a press tour to promote a record that I'd put out, and somebody goes, "So you were on Louie?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "What's Louie like?" And I was like, "Well, why don't you go ask Louie? You know, the fuck do I look like, a publicist?"
Cross this question off.
Yeah, it really bothers me when people start asking me, like, yeah, you know, "You're friends with Bill Burr. What's he like?"
Damn it, that was my next one.
Go fucking interview Bill. I don't, you know what I mean?
Keith Robert. Okay, we'll Robinson, cross that one off too. Bobby Kelly. Okay. All right. Added the fat a little bit. That's a good way to start
Great.
This off.
Good.
So, Joe, is this your first time in Rochester?
No. It's my first time at this club.
Right.
But no, I've been, I guess, my third time maybe.
Right on.
I think something like that, yeah.
Well, it's nice to have you back in town. People are excited
Thanks.
To see you.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, man.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I'm glad to be here. I like this place.
You are a very busy person, man. You're a very busy guy, doing television writing, acting a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was doing a lot of that stuff. I'm doing mostly just stand-up right now.
Okay.
Which is good. It's a nice change of pace. You know, kind of not having the 9-to-5 hours, you
right.
know?
Right.
But yeah, for a few years it was like, that was kind of, because I'd gone out to L.A. and that was kind of the focus. I was like, why you would go out there.
Right.
Certainly wasn't for the social advantages.
It wasn't for the amazing, easy commutes.
Yeah, you know how you get tired of really awesome bars and wonderful people? And then you say, well, let me go to L.A. for a while. And you get tired of fantastic restaurants everywhere. Well, let me go to L.A. That's why I went there, was just for work stuff.
Interesting.
And it went on for a few years. And you know, now I'm kind of doing a little more stuff for myself. So I think it's time to come back east.
Okay.
Live in an environment that's a little more stand-up centric for a while again.
If yeah. you moved from L.A., is there anything you'd miss from there?
No.
Okay. That's honest. Oh, fine. Screw it. I mean,
Amoeba Records. I like Amoeba Records quite a bit.
Okay. Good record store.
Great record store.
Yeah.
Great record store.
While you're in town, check out the Record Archive.
Good spot?
It's the biggest record store on the East Coast, man.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
How close is it to where we are right now?
3 minutes.
Great.
Yeah,
I want to go to there, and I want to go to Game Craze.
Okay.
Because I'm a big video game collector.
Okay.
And I want to go to this Play Museum or whatever it's called.
Oh, Museum of Play. It's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll get some quarters, man. We'll go to the arcade.
All right.
They got a crazy old school arcade in there.
Those are my three stops for tomorrow. One, two, three.
You're going to have a play day.
I'm going to have a play day. outside of the hotel room for once.
Who would have thought? Rochester, New York is a city that gets you out of the hotel room, right?
Well, I mean, but that's the thing. Rochester, these types of cities are usually where the cool stuff is. You know,
we have to try harder.
The cities that have a bit of, you know, that still have that sort of a quaint, you know, quaint side to them, or you know, or a small town soul. You know, it's like these are the places that usually have the coolest stuff. You know, it's much harder to find the cool stuff in a big super metropolis developed city because there's a lot of stuff between you and the thing you want to get to, and then a lot of that real estate becomes very commercial
and gets bought out.
So I find the coolest stuff in these towns. I mean, that's why Guy Fieri is always in. You know what I mean?
I thought it was because I paid him.
I thought it was because he was lost.
That's so funny. But, you know, he's rarely in, like, San Francisco. You know what I mean?
Sure.
He's in, like, these little
Moose
places.
Knuckle, Arkansas.
Yeah. Like, and you're like, man, I want to go there. That restaurant looks awesome.
And the late, great Anthony Bourdain, same thing.
Yeah, exactly. There. Not to knock San Francisco. I like San Francisco. But I will knock Los Angeles.
Better than L.A.
Yeah.
So you've been doing stand-up comedy for a very long time, and you were one of the first comics that I know of that really embraced the internet for podcasting type radio stuff.
That's so weird. They just said that to me on Weeze's show.
Well, they copy me a lot.
But no, I've never known myself to be associated with that in any way.
Really?
So when they said that this morning, I was like, well, I mean,
didn't you do an internet radio show back in 2009, like around 10 years ago?
Well, Burr and I did Uninformed.
Right.
But I mean, you know, it was streaming. It wasn't internet. It was Sirius.
Right.
But, or XM. I can't remember which one it was. It was before they merged.
Right.
But, you know, I was like, well, now that you mention it, Bobby Kelly and I did used to do, like, before they were called podcasts, we would record these things on this like phone app, and then we would sit at his table and do it on his computer, and Burr and I, when we would do Uninformed, we would do it over the phone sometimes.
Right.
And you'd have to record it through this phone service that they must have charged something, but I don't remember paying anything, and it would upload to this, like, it wasn't a cloud back then, it was like
a hardwired server.
That you had to like pull the the showdown from, and then like, but like the, before I did any of that, I worked for the Texas State Senate,
right?
And I did an internet radio show for them that recapped what was happening in the legislative sessions each day, and that was internet radio, but it was literally I would record everything myself in a single booth, to Pro Tools, and then I would upload it through dial-up to a phone server.
Are you telling me that Texas wasn't at the forefront of internet technology?
It was the forefront back then. That was like at that time. This is 2000.
Yeah,
that was like that's pretty crazy back then. Mm-hmm. You know, when they said it's a radio show, I remember being like, "But I don't understand it. It's not. Where's the radio station?" And they were like, "No. We upload it to this, and then radio stations around the state pull down your story and play it."
So do you think
And that was crazy back then.
Yeah.
Like that was, I'm not crazy, but it was pretty ahead of its time.
It was a novel idea. I mean, when did everybody start getting a computer in their homes? 96?
I remember this guy 97? Mike, who sat at the desk next to me in the Senate. I remember him almost bragging to all of us in the office that he got Ethernet in his house. And
cool
it was
guy.
Like, we were all like, whoa, you know, like that was a big deal. You know, I didn't have Ethernet for years after that, until years after that. It was a different time, man.
Yeah,
it
really was. I remember getting my first cable internet in 98 or 99. And I was like, holy shit. Like it changed. Like you couldn't believe it.
Yeah. It's a different scene, you know,
yeah.
But I mean, you know, this was so I was a pioneer of internet radio.
Well, yes, you invented it. Really,
I invented
is what I have in the notes. So tell me about what is Louis like? well, I'm just asking you because I'm kind of interested in how that helped your career, like starting out, like when you were really getting into comedy, when you're doing something like that that's as accessible to the fans that nobody else really is doing. Nowadays, everybody has a podcast. You technically had one when nobody did. So I guess I'm just wondering is like, how did you see that help your career at that time? Did it help?
No, because I have a real knack for doing things at exactly the wrong time.
Okay.
So I was doing it with other people when not a lot of people were doing it and nobody was accessing it because it wasn't a thing yet. And then when people started to access it and it became a thing, I was like, I don't want to do that anymore, which was real bright. And then I thought, let me return to it once everybody's tired of it. Right. So, so at that time, it really didn't. It just, I mean, or maybe it did. I don't know. But it wasn't like people were reaching out and saying, oh, hey, man. But I know that Bobby, doing the show with Bobby and doing the show with Bill back then, we did have listeners. We did have fans. Sorry, I dropped a piece of trash on the ground. Right. It was an accident. And, you know, to this day, people will still come up to me and say, you know, oh, man, Uninformed with you and Burr. I loved it, you know. And it's funny because we just started doing it again. So I'll go, and that's what's so funny about this. I'll go, well, we started doing it again. There's 12 new episodes out. And they go, really? Oh, you know, so it's like they remember this thing that was completely, you know, off the grid and under the radar. And now that it's this common thing, it's like people miss it because.
Did you expect them to stay subscribed?
No, I just mean like it's so much harder to reach the people now because you're tossing it out into the ocean at this point.
Because you're one of thousands instead of one of four.
Is it even thousands? Is it millions at this point? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It really is. We use Podomatic for our server for this show, and I looked at how many shows are actually in the comedy category just on the Podomatic servers. I think there was like 40,000 or so.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of shows, man.
From all over the freaking world.
It's a lot of shows. But, I mean, at this point, if you can crack through in any way, you're doing okay.
Yeah.
If you're making any money off the, I mean, see, here's the thing. It's expanded now to a point that you can. It's becoming. There are so many subdivisions of fans that you know you can cater directly. You know, Carlin had that book, or excuse me, that bit about magazines, and this was 1990. One, I think, or something, and he goes, any activity with at least three people dedicated to it has a magazine devoted to it.
Yeah,
and he went through all the different magazines, and you know, I think that the internet and these shows are very similar now. It's become so big that you can just deliver things directly to the exact demographic.
Yep.
You want to deliver them to and still make some cash out of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, as long as you're striking a nerve and people are dedicated to it.
Yeah, so,
yeah.
You know, it's an interesting time. But I find the internet, overall nowadays, I find the internet very useful.
Sure.
Yeah.
When you first started watching comedy, obviously it was probably television specials, Tonight Show and stuff like that.
Yeah, the first thing I ever remember seeing was Bill Cosby himself.
Hmm.
Which to this day I still say is the greatest piece of stand-up ever committed to tape.
I wouldn't take that. I don't think you can take that away from him. Yeah, that is an amazing special.
It's. I saw that when I was 6 years old with my parents, and I was laughing as hard as my parents were from a child's perspective, while they were laughing from the parents' perspective.
I remember. I have the exact same memory. Yeah, because I was probably eight. Something
yeah,
like that.
That's a fascinating piece of work.
Yeah,
and I don't think anything has ever tackled the family dynamic the way that did, like, so that that blows my mind. It's and you know, obviously it's you know, I would rival it with Pryor, you know, Live in Concert, and
sure,
and my favorite Carlin is probably Back in Town, but you know, that was my first exposure to it. And then but when I, the real monumental moment for me with stand up was seeing Carlin for the first time at about 12 years old.
You went and saw Carlin at 12?
No, my cousin showed it to me on HBO.
Okay.
And I just was like, this is amazing. Like, here's a guy older than my parents telling me that all the stuff my parents are telling me is stupid.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really amazing form of rebellion to experience at that age.
Yeah, I remember seeing Carl in the first. I remember. I think I was older than that when I saw. But even then, thinking, "Wow, my parents would not like this." You know,
yeah.
It was just so they would not like this guy.
Yeah,
this
it's
stuff.
Funny. My parents grew to really love Carlin after I started doing comedy because I loved him so much. But it's the, you know, and it's it fell right in line with everything I liked. It fell right in line with gangster rap and eventually punk rock music and heavy metal and Frank Sinatra and gritty, you know, independent films, and everything I liked had that real, you know, fuck you nature to it.
Yeah.
That's what I got attracted to. And I just loved, I loved it. I loved it. That was a very, very life-changing moment for me.
So as a young teenager, you see Carlin. How old were you when you stepped on stage the first time?
24?
Okay.
I think.
So those Carlin seeds really just took a while to grow. They didn't, like, you didn't necessarily just chase stand up.
Well, no, I played music first.
That's okay.
The other big like, you know, game changer for me at that period was Ice-T.
Okay.
And I wanted to be a rapper. That's what I wanted to do first before anything else. I loved the rebellious nature of rap music. I loved it. Especially being a kid that came from a sort of strict Catholic household, growing up in going to a Catholic school, living in a very, very white community that didn't have a lot of diversity, that was very much in, you know, I love where I came from, but there was a certain bit of lockstep to it where this is what you do, and this is what you think, and this is how you do it, and all that. Yeah. So, Ice-T was a big one for me, and I wanted to be a musician, and I played music and wrote music for years and years and years. And then it wasn't until I got into college that I started to get tired of dealing with other people, and I started to really develop this sense of independence, and I started to really realize what it was I didn't like about, you know, group mentality and groupthink and the things that came along with grouping up with other people, which in a band was necessary. And I wanted initially to be Henry Rollins.
Okay.
You know, or Jello Biafra. I wanted to be a spoken word guy. I wanted to be somebody that could just get up and sort of read these essays that I'd written. It was about opinions to me. It wasn't about funny. But Carlin was a guy I kept going back to, and he was the guy that showed me there's a way you can do this, and this is your in. If you can figure out how to make this funny, you can get in.
Yeah, way to do both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because with Biafra and Rollins, it was like, well, if, you know, be the front man of an iconic punk band that changes things, and then, you know, eventually, you know, and it was like, it just seemed impossible. Like, that wasn't a job that people had.
Right.
But a job that people did have was stand-up comedy. So I was like, okay, that's, you can do that. You can do that, you know?
Now, didn't you approach stand-up musically? Didn't you have a group when you first started? Weren't you in a thing? In a,
they also asked me this on Wheeze today. Are you guys sharing notes?
I'm going to freaking kill them. No.
Yeah, no, I had a... Well, I didn't... That's not how I started, but I did early on have a comedy rap group.
Okay. So the first time you stepped on stage, you approached it as pure stand-up.
No, when I first started doing it, I had a partner who was also a school teacher, my friend Dan, who was also a school teacher. Mm-hmm. And we would go on stage together and do weird sketches and funny songs and, you know, just a, it was kind of like an Andy Kaufman-ish kind of thing. We thought
it
like
seems the way a lot of college kids go when they first start. Yeah,
yeah. It was like, let's be irreverent and weird and, you know, and and edgy and all this stuff. You know, and we did that for a few weeks together at a bar in our hometown. I was about 20, like I said, about 20. God, 20. Yeah, but 24. And then. No, I couldn't. No, I wasn't 24. I was 22. Because I had just Maybe 23. I don't know. Somewhere in there.
Somewhere in the early 20s. 20s.
Christ.
You could drink. You were allowed to drink.
Yeah. I was probably 23 because I'm 42 now, and I'm about, I'm getting somewhere in the 19-year range. Anyway, we were doing that sort of stuff, and then he didn't want to do it anymore because he had a job, and he was like, I don't really, you know. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, I guess now's my chance.
I'm going solo.
Yeah, if I ever wanted to try stand up, I could try it now, and I did, and that's mm-hmm. that's how it started for me. But when I first started, though, it was very. I was trying to do what I do now, which is offer opinions, but I didn't understand how to make them funny back then. I thought all you had to do was make them vicious, and that would be enough.
Yeah, it's an easy mistake to make.
Yeah, and I learned.
Being mean how'd you or learn being the lesson? Is easy.
Yeah.
How'd you learn that lesson? Anything particular stand out? Because I feel like that's one that a lot of people really need to think about before they jump into comedy a little bit.
Honestly, I just learned it because I was so new to it, and I was pretty open to hearing constructive feedback from my friends. My friends were my only barometer at that point.
Right.
And my friend Scott, who I knew had my back and I knew really believed in me and I knew would be honest with me, was just like, yeah, dude, it's funny, but like you should have more jokes.
Yeah.
Like he was like, that's not a joke to just say, I hate this, XYZ, blah, blah, blah. He goes like,
right.
And it just kind of resonated with me. And so then the second time I did it, I actually tried telling jokes, and there was a noticeable jump in the reaction from the audience. Mm-hmm. So then I started going down that road for about a year where I was like, oh, this is how you do this. And I kind of put the initial thing on the back burner. And then about a year and a half or so in is when I started to be like, I want to talk about stuff I care about. Like, I don't want to just tell jokes. I want to talk about things I'm interested in, things that set me off. And that was the initial interest. I want to be able to rant about things that, and I eventually start to figure out slowly how to make my opinions funny. Right. But I mean, it was a long road, you know.
You do a really good job of being angry, clearly angry on stage, but still being very funny. And that's something too that I've always tried. A couple of years ago, I started just being more angry on stage, and it worked out. But it is something that it's been going fine.
Okay.
But you know, that is something that's, it's a hard gear to find. And I think like what you were saying, a lot of comics try that too early. And it just, you sound like you're doing a TED talk. You know,
well, yeah,
like,
and I mean, you know, Burr gave me great advice once. He was like, figure out what you're actually upset about up there.
Oh, yeah.
Because otherwise you're just going to be the angry guy. He's like, you don't want to be that. And he was right, you know, because at the time I was yelling about text messages. And it was a lot of forced intensity and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And once I started to find things I cared about, really cared about, that I had a real opinion on, suddenly there was no more fake anger. It was just, there was a passion that's still there, but the anger part to me kind of went away. And it was more about being passionate,
mm-hmm.
and the natural annoyance that I felt with these things just came out organically.
Yeah.
Instead of getting up there and being like, okay, here we go. I'm going to rant and rave now. You know what I mean? Like, so that's, that was the big thing for me.
Do you find that easier the older you get, too? Like, you just have that stereotypical, you know, over 40 anger mode that, you know, I think.
No, in fact, a lot of, I try to make it very clear now that I'm not doing that to the audience. In fact, last night I said several times on stage, I go, I really want to make this clear. I'm not this guy. I'm not the guy that's like, you know, and I'm tired of this and you can't say this anymore. That's not who I am. You know, I'm somebody, I feel that disappointed and dejected summarizes me much more than angry does.
Yeah.
You know?
You know?
I'm all three.
Yeah, well, it's why.
I've never heard a comic described as that, though, by audience members. They're, oh, that's the angry comic. Oh, that's the, that comic. I've never, that's the disappointed, dejected comic.
It's why I called my Comedy Central special, You Let Me Down, because that's how I feel. It's a feeling, it's a thing I learned from Carlin. It's, you know, anger turns into condescension. And I don't want to be condescending.
Yeah.
I'm not up there to tell people they're stupid. I'm not up there to tell them I'm right. Mm-hmm. I'm up there to say, this is how I feel about my place in all of this.
Yeah.
And that the way I feel is disappointed. It's I feel let down. I was promised an array of things, and I was as a child, and it was all a bill of goods. It was all horseshit. God was not there to protect me. You know, the government was not reliable.
There's no flying cars.
Yeah, voting was horseshit.
Yeah,
most authority figures were corrupt. You know, this concept of finding the one was fairy tale nonsense. You know, the list goes on and on. You know, the church let me down, certainly, you know. So it was like, it was just, that to me is what it was all about. It was disappointment. It was stepping to the outside and going, this doesn't make sense to me anymore. And I don't really want to be a part of it. So I'm just going to kind of commentate on it now, you know.
Now,
whereas anger, I think, is a little more angsty and, you know, like, we need a change, people.
Yeah, you're still trying to fix it, I think, when you're angry.
I'm not trying to, I'm just kind of giving my take on it.
Yeah.
You know, so hopeless is a lot of...
hopeless.
Hopeless meaning you're not, but I mean, this is the thing. People hear a word like hopeless and they go, oh my God, that's so dark and that's so sad. And it's like, no, it's not. If you just kind of accept this is what it is, suddenly that's not a sad thing anymore. It's just a reality. It's okay. You know, I used to have a bit about brutality, human brutality. And I go, the sooner you accept that this is just another way you can die, the sooner life's going to get a lot easier for you. You know, what happened to that guy? Oh, I got cancer, terrible, a very aggressive diet. What happened to her? Car accident, hydroplane, hit a tree. What happened to him? Oh, his neighbor cut his face off, wart on his face, fucked him to death in a doghouse. You go, hey, man, when it's your time, it's your time. You know what I mean?
It's your time, baby.
It's like that's just part of it. It's just part of it. It's never, ever, ever going to go away.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, it's like the sooner we accept these truths about us as people and accept that there are just very, very, very unfortunate realities out there, and it's like you're going to get through life a lot easier.
It's a very therapeutic way of looking at it.
I think so. But, you know, everybody wants to fucking, you know, change the world.
Do people ever try to argue that with you?
All the time.
Really?
All the time. All the time. Oh, that's so, you know, and but you got to have hope and you got to have this. And at the end of the day, what it all boils down to is people want to bullshit themselves.
Yeah, I mean, you talk to a really, really hopeful person like that. You're like, how many times do you have to get fooled? Like, how many times?
In one way or another, you're bullshitting yourself. And you really see it past 40. When people get past 40, they have to subscribe to things that allow them to have their demigods and their... and their cults and their followings and their ideologies and all these things, you really see it in people after 40. And they either go super corporate or super religious or super political. They do it with something most of the time because they need to have this structural thing that lets
them believe in.
Yeah, and it's bullshit at the end of the day. It's like...
just what's your brand?
Yeah, it's like you know, as futile as praying is to me... you could apply that to the Occupy movement. What did it do?
Yeah.
What did it do?
Right.
You sat down there. You played your bongos. You talked about how corrupt it was. You talked about how fucked up it was. You got arrested. People talked about it in coffee houses. It distracted us all for a little while, and it's business as usual on Wall Street. And the great white hope president that we thought would have been the guy that had our backs through all of it is the one that excused all the bankers. You know, Obama's the one that pardoned everybody. So it's like, what did it do? It's all bullshit. It's just believing in all of these things to try to help you sleep better at night, which is fine. My parents are religious. Great on them. I have friends that are political. Good on them. You know, I have other friends that are very business-minded. Good on them. Do your thing. It's not for me. It's not for me. I'd rather look at it the way I look at it, you know, which is also why I don't present it as a way on stage of saying, I'm correct. Mm-hmm. I just say, this is how I feel about it.
Yeah.
God bless, man. You know?
It's your modern day philosopher, sir.
Oh, well, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, that's why my bank account is empty.
Yeah, mostly. Exactly right.
I don't think Socrates was rolling in it back in the day.
Well, either, yeah, I'm not comparing myself to the philosopher. No, that's nice of you to say.
What you're doing and the way you approach stand-up is very impressive to me for a lot of reasons, because it comes from a place of trying to have integrity and not knowing that you know all the answers. And being able to let people laugh at the darkness, like I said, is very therapeutic. It's one of those things where I think that when you realize it's a joke, you know, when you realize it's funny and you think about it in a way like that, it doesn't seem as dark to deal with. And maybe it's a lot easier than deluding yourself with thinking you could change the world.
It's just, you know, I learned so much from Carlin. I mean, I really, he's a religion, almost a religion to me or something. Or he is a philosopher to me. I really think that his, and it's kind of a dream or a hope of mine to one day maybe be able to get to teach a college course that teaches his philosophy. Because I think it's fucking spot on.
I'm pretty sure you could probably find about 10 colleges in the next hour that would hire you.
We got
to
a community college down the street, probably take it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. How do you do that? How do you get into college? You got to go and pitch the class?
I don't know. Yeah.
I have no idea how you do that. But
they let me guest teach there, so I'm sure they would have give you a full time course.
He did a lecture about bicycles. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, no.
and his take of his overall take, which was when you're born to this world, you get a ticket to the show, and if you're born in America, you get a front row seat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was like, that's all this is to me. It's a show. I have no investment in any of this, in the outcome of any of this.
Yeah.
And he says in one of his books, and he goes, and by the way, if you do happen to figure all this out, I still don't want to be part of it. You know?
Right.
But that really, really resonated with me. And then, and also too, again, the older you get, the more you realize how selfish these motives are that people have, how narrow-minded and sort of narrowly viewed these people's takes on change and social betterment and all this shit is. It's bullshit. Mm-hmm. It's bullshit. It's about them and their little square. You know, I say it all the time. I love that the people I hear complaining loudest about Trump building a wall live in gated communities.
Right.
Yeah.
These people are full of shit.
And now it's like we have access to all the information in the world, and we just focus on the stuff that reinforces what we already thought.
Yeah.
You know,
so it's,
well, that's else. Because of, I mean, we could go down a rabbit hole here, but the way that we have set up marketing in this country is ridiculous. Everything is tailored to everybody. They will tell you what you want to hear all day long right from your phone, mm-hmm. whether it's to get you to buy something or whether it's to get you to think something.
Yeah, you have a curated, constant stream of information in your pocket. It is delivering you everything you already agree with and already are interested in on a 24-hour basis. And people have no idea how damaging that truly can be. It's why I went back to an iPhone 6e, because it was the most limited phone that could also switch over to 5G when 5G happened. I didn't want my phone to not work.
Right, yeah.
You know, at some point you have to plug into all of this and live, you know, mm-hmm. as a person with their own business or you know. But I went back, I cut the news thing is cut off. I cut all that shit off of the phone.
Yeah.
Texting, email, phone calls, Uber. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it, you know.
It's really all a man needs.
Because it's like it's sickening. It's like you know, tell us what stories you have, and then everything is collecting this data, you know. Mm-hmm. I just got a what is it called? The Kindle Fire HD. Mm-hmm. And you know, yesterday it asked me, it's like, can we collect information on what apps you use the most? I was like, no, you cannot. You know, I'm not doing this. I'm not living in a world where I'm being fed everything I already know I'm interested in. Let me see what else is going on. Let me see the other perspective.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I disagree. If I disagree with you wholeheartedly, let's talk about it. I want to understand where you're coming from, even if I don't agree with it.
And that's the very principle that I feel is completely missing in the way people think these days.
It's gone. Mm-hmm.
It is completely gone. Objectivity about other people's opinions is completely out the window in 2019. It just is.
It's gone.
I'm guilty of it. A lot of people are guilty of it. We're all... What?
Nothing.
Why'd you whisper at me?
I didn't whisper at
you. Yes, you did.
I mouthed at you.
What did you mouth at me?
I said Mark's out there.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Oh. All right.
Yeah. Listening. Why are you interrupting the show?
I mouthed it at you and you called it out.
Yeah.
My podcast host will do that. Show. I'll mouth something off mic and I'll go, what are you saying? And I go,
I know.
I was mouthing it to you. So you...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
As long as I've done the show two
Joe's
years
on,
with this
Joe's
guy,
on my side. On
he's
this
never
one.
Mouthed anything at Joe's me on in the middle of the show. And for him to do it was insanely
it's a
weird.
Big, well, you've never had a philosopher on the show.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And I'm trying to have a conversation with one, and this numbnuts can't hold it. He's like, look, Mark walked by, Vinny.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, God damn, go outside. Go watch the cars.
I think Joe's on my side with this one.
I'm on...
Fine.
Yeah, he's on my
fine.
I'm on.
Fine.
I'm on both of you. I don't have a stake in it.
He learned from Carla. Yeah. I was sit back and watch. Yeah, burned out. Back where we were.
That'll make the Christmas.
We're
special.
Missing. We're missing the objectivity to be able to even stop and think about the way other people think. Any thoughts on how we fix that? Just out of curiosity.
There is no way to fix it. You the ceiling's just... too high in this country. The ceiling is way too high. Low ceiling means change can happen, progress can happen. Then it hits a point where everybody has way, way, way too much accessibility to everything all the time, constantly. And you eventually see systems of belief go hand in hand with economic prosperity and this sort of thing. Like, you know, for instance, like in Hollywood, there's a very certain way of thinking amongst celebrities. There is a certain political stance that celebrities take.
Correct.
And celebrities that do not subscribe to that are very tight-lipped about it. And the ones that aren't are not as celebrated. It's just the reality of it. Now, this is not me going, the damn liberals are, you know. It's just what the reality of it is.
Speaking clinically, ladies and gentlemen.
It's just what the reality of it is. Mm-hmm. So fine, but that's where we're at. We're at a place where you can't change it. Too much money is at stake.
Yeah,
The hard right has too much to gain economically to compromise. The hard left is the same thing. Why would anybody change? Why would anybody change? It's not a battle for what's right. It's a battle for control.
So at some point, Joe.
I mean, this is micro. It's everything is Microsoft versus Apple.
Okay.
Or Samsung versus Apple or
Pepsi, Coke, whatever.
Yeah, it's all Pepsi. It's all been boiled down to the big two.
So let me ask you this question because I'm actually really fascinated by this. This is stuff I think about a lot. At some point, this generation is going to be dead. I'm going to be dead. You're going to be dead. We're all going to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
And the next generation is going to be left with the rubble of what we are leaving them.
Right.
What, you have any thoughts as to what it's going to look like? I mean, do you think... I mean, what are we doing?
I think it'll just look like a refaced version of what it is now, you know? And I think for the
same
last...
Same as it ever was.
Yeah, I think for the last, probably 100 years, that's kind of what it's been anyway. You know what I mean? Maybe a little less than that. But, like... That's kind of what it's been. It's just the same thing, sort of getting resurfaced or refaced, rather, and refurbished. And I don't think now is the worst time of all time. I'm not one of those people. Sure. I'm not one of those people. I joke in my act that the end is coming soon, but I don't really think that. I think I'm not one of these self-involved people that thinks, you know, I'm going to be the one to witness the end of time and, you know, I'm seeing human brutality at its worst and all these things.
There can only be one of us, Joe.
Yeah.
There can only be one of us.
Yeah. I love that shit, though, right? This is right. The most awful time in history. Yeah, why don't you go tell that to a slave?
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, from 17.
I remember the 40s being it's like, pretty bad.
Yeah, it's like, you know, give me a fucking break, right? Yeah. So it's like, I just think it all gets repackaged and refaced and redistributed. So, you know, I have no idea what the future will look like, but I don't think it's going to be that different from this.
Right. Yeah, I think you know? It's become pretty efficient at maintaining the status quo.
I mean, look, most if you look at science fiction, most interpretation, or not most, but I shouldn't say, but many, many interpretations of the future in science fiction are this. It's one side versus the other. The bad guys are in power. The rebellion has to overthrow.
And they all think they're the good guys.
Yeah, you know, and they all think they're doing the right thing. But it is two sides, light and dark, and that's it. You know, so I don't think that's that different from what's going on right now.
No.
You know, I just watched a really interesting documentary called Slay the Dragon about gerrymandering and what the Republicans did with gerrymandering in Michigan and Wisconsin. And it was insane. They redrew the lines so they could basically control winning the districts, which is exactly what you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to let a district vote for what they believe in. But they rigged the game. But the part in the and it's a fascinating documentary. And they actually, in the ultimate spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it.
Iron Man dies at the end.
Yeah, they crucify Jesus at the end. You know what? I won't spoil the end. The ultimate point of the documentary is gerrymandering is fucked and shouldn't go on.
Right.
But I think a lot of people in the theater missed the point that pre the Republicans doing this,
Democrats
in the the 80s, Reagan was bitching about it with the Democrats doing it for the same reason. And you know, it's unfortunate to me that that side of the argument doesn't necessarily get explored. It's usually yeah, but when they did it, it was worse. On either side,
right?
Versus either side saying, you know, we all did this and it's fucked up and we should stop doing it. You know,
it's a constant circle of finger pointing, no matter what the issue is, gerrymandering or whatever.
Yeah.
So again, it's back to that. It's a fight for the scepter. You know what I mean? It's who's in control. You know. So there were parts in this documentary where I was going, "Wow, the Republicans are really fucked up." There were also parts of this documentary where I was going, "Wait, are the Democrats just mad that they lost power?" Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
yeah.
And I kept going back and forth. You know. And again, my take at the very end of it was, it just seems like it's two groups warring for authority, you know? And what bothered... Oh, go ahead.
It's almost a circular firing squad sometimes, too, I think, where they just...
That's the worst kind of firing squad, bro.
Right.
You know, no, I'm saying they're just screwing each other, you know, and nobody's getting... Nothing's happening.
And what bothers me is to see people applauding basically a documentary that's saying your vote doesn't matter because the Electoral College is horseshit.
Because it just went... Right
well, because these are the people applauding are the same people that yell at me for not voting.
Right.
And I go, well, your vote doesn't matter. Yes, it does. You have to vote. You just told me that they rigged the election. Why should I vote? No, because you have to. So here we are, back to praying.
Who are you to argue with P. Diddy?
You know what I mean?
Really, John? Yeah. Who are you to argue with P. Diddy?
Here we are, back to praying. Did you feel better last night because you went and pulled a fucking lever?
I got the sticker.
A little bit.
I got that
you know?
Sticker.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I wore my I voted sticker. I wore my cross. I wore my... Is any of it... It's all bullshit to me. Anyway. Sorry. That's my take.
What's that quote from... that Alan Moore quote from Watchmen? The comedian, he says, when you realize that everything's a joke, the only thing that makes sense is being the comedian.
Right.
That's what he says.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Either way. So let's talk about something interesting. How's Better Call Saul? When's the new season coming out?
I don't really know. I mean, it comes out soon, I guess. But you know, I'm not a regular, so I'm there. Sure. I'm there when they bring me in, and I'm happy to be there. But I don't really have any lowdown on anything.
Okay.
But I think it's coming out soon, and I think they just announced they're going to do one more season after that.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that.
Which I think is great. I think it's great that they're going to do a finite thing mm-hmm. and end it and keep it, you know, perfect.
Yeah, those guys are really good at knowing when to stop.
Yeah.
Well, you're a writer. I think you understand the virtue of having knowing a really good ending and building towards it's important.
It's nice in entertainment. It's nice in American entertainment when people know when to pull the plug.
Yeah.
Because usually we don't. It goes on and 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 on.
That's like all my favorite British shows. You get 3 seasons, 12 episodes, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know.
And the ones that tend to go on for a while. I shouldn't say that. Sometimes a show will keep going, but they deliver the goods, and when that happens, that's great.
I think it's easier to keep a comedy going than it is a dramatic show, though. Like a dramatic show, it's much harder to keep going for a really long time because there's a storyline there, you know, and like a sitcom.
I think both. It's hard with either, because a good drama will always risk getting into soap opera territory, and a good comedy will always risk getting into repeating itself and rehashing. So it's tough. I mean, but the shows that are able to do it, that's amazing to me. Mm-hmm. That's amazing to me.
When you're writing for television or writing for characters, it's got to be like a completely different side of your brain than writing your own stand-up, right?
I mean, sort of. In some ways, but sometimes you just go, oh, that bit that I thought of that would be funny, that's actually a funny situation you could create.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And put characters into. Or, oh, what if I had a character, the person I'm writing about in this joke that's annoying me, that's actually a good character. You know, the person that believes these things or whatever. That's a good character for a TV show, you know. So it's obviously a very different muscle to exercise, but it's not like, I wouldn't say they're unrelated.
Right, okay.
You know, yeah.
I mean, I just always think, you know, in terms of stand-up, as you're writing for yourself and you're telling a story, and then, you know, writing for television or something, that you're trying to paint a whole picture and have, even though you're doing that, but you have to think about how other people are going to be doing and saying. And I get terrified thinking about that. Mm-hmm. Did you want to be a TV? I mean, you did it. Did you always want to be a TV writer, or did it just, you just kind of fall into it?
No, I mean, I wanted to do it just so I could have it on my resume so I could do my own stuff.
Okay.
You know, one of the things I always heard about Louis was he had a lot of experience on his resume working on other people's stuff, so when he got his shot to do his own thing, he was able to say, I can do this look. And that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah,
Ricky Gervais, you know, like, so I, you know, I wrote for many years on TV shows, got into the WGA, I directed some stuff, got into the DGA, you know, it's all just pieces. So, you know, now I'm trying to sell a screenplay that I want to direct.
Do you have a part for A Fat Best Friend?
No.
Okay.
I love that you're the first person. He asks that all the time.
No, I don't.
You're the first person just to flat out go, no.
Well, if it makes you feel better, I'm not in the movie either. So, okay. Yeah.
Do you need a fat assistance?
I might.
Do you need a grip? Do you need a portly grip?
I might.
Portly grip.
Yeah, okay. That might, now that might come in handy.
Hollywood, here we come.
He's great at picking out donuts.
Yeah. I have to go pee.
Not for other people. It's nice meeting you, Joe.
It was nice meeting you too, man. This is really fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for telling us all about how the world is going to end. We appreciate you. There's 4 more shows this weekend at Comedy at the Carlson. Get your tickets, 585-4-COMEDY. Come see Joe this weekend. You're going to regret it if you don't.
Because there you go. I was going
to say. Yeah, that was a good pause.
That was an awkward pause.
Yeah. It was
Sometimes
great.
I just like to play with everybody.
By the way, the show is actually funny.
Yes.
I'm Today not this. It's not me on stage just being like, you know, people, why even try? It's not like, it's funny. There's a lot of jokes.
Well, if you haven't offed yourself during this whole conversation, you realize how hopeless everything was. We'll see you at the show. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
We're going to be right back with the news with Ross Johnson. Stay tuned, everybody.
Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in to the Comedy at the Carlson Cast. I want to say thanks to our great friends. How about Chef Joe over at Sapori Cafe and Catering? They're located inside of the Powers Building Atrium downtown and have the best lunch specials you're going to find in Rochester. And to top it off, they can cater your very own special event. Visit at Sapori Rochester on Instagram and find them on Facebook for more information. You could also check out our good friends over at Three Heads Brewing. Jeff and the boys over there make the finest beers you're going to find this side of the Genesee River. And they also have an amazing, amazing brewery with live music just about every night of the week. Check out threeheadsbrewing.com for more information there. And we also want to say thanks to our friends at Iron Smoke Whiskey. Always remember to drink responsibly, but they make delicious stuff. They make Rattlesnake Rosie's Apple Pie Whiskey and a traditional Applewood Smoked Whiskey. Visit ironsmokewhiskey.com or you can visit their tasting room on Parse Avenue in Fairport. So thanks, sponsors. Now it's time for a show. Thank you for being awesome and watching another episode of the Carlson Cast. Don't forget we're streaming live on Facebook and YouTube every Friday morning. You could also follow us on social media on Twitter and Instagram at CarlsonCast. You can listen anytime on iTunes, Google Play, and we're now available on Spotify. You should also check out an amazing app called Laughable. And on the Laughable app, you can connect to your favorite comedians in a way you never thought you could before. Download it in the App Store and visit carlsoncast.com for information on more shows. And don't be a jerk. Rate and review.
Well, here we go. It's that time where everyone's favorite sit-down newsman does stand-up news. There he is, ladies and gentlemen, the incomparable Ross Johnson.
Wow, he's on fire today. Look at the look in his eyes.
He's on
you
fire.
You can see it.
I did not want to start with death this week. I swear to you,
but
I did not.
But here we are.
But here we are.
Started off this week on Who's Death.
Here we are. So this was a hard story to avoid this week. Very sad. So this past Sunday, David Kimowitz lived in Maplewood, New Jersey. He was a guy who he was a club owner in New York City. He managed several comedians. He owned the Strand Restaurant and Comedy Club in New York City. He was murdered in his home along with his au pair. This is all, you know, under investigation and allegedly, et cetera, et cetera. But
could you explain what au pair means to Cam? He's from Tennessee.
It's like a nanny. It's like the lady from Sweden who takes care of you. It's a fancy nanny.
It's a nanny with an accent.
Yeah.
A nanny from somewhere else?
Yes.
I don't know if that's the case here specifically, but generally you think of an au pair, you think of like a lady from Sweden. Yeah.
All right. So
she's the pretty lady that you anyway. So the au pair's boyfriend, again, this is all under investigation, so a lot of this is allegedly, etc., but the au pair's boyfriend has been arrested. He apparently, there was an altercation, he had a key, she tried to get the key back, he came in, murdered her along with the David Kimowitz, the comedy club owner, who is apparently very prominent in the community,
aside
from being popular with local comedians, but he was also a little bit of a philanthropist. And
his club, The Stand, is considered a comics club. It really is, like, the place to go. Like, nothing against the cellar or any of those places, but The Stand has built quite a reputation for itself very quickly. So a lot of the people we've had on this show were super close. Big Jay Oakerson and him were super tight.
Who gave the closing eulogy at the funeral.
Did he really?
Yep.
No, did he?
You know, the most tone-deaf thing I saw this week, and I shouldn't laugh, but it really...
It's a lot of tone-deaf stuff, so this is going
to
be interesting.
I had to send it to somebody. Opie from the old Opie and Anthony show, Big J posted a picture of him and David and them hugging and embracing right after Jay, I believe, either found out that he was doing his one-hour comedy special or after he had filmed it. And he posted the picture and said, hey, you know, this is a picture of me and David right after, you know, I found out about the one-hour special. Opie from that show posted underneath it, congratulations, man, well-deserved.
Oh, my God.
And it's so, oh, it was so bad. I felt like, oh, no.
Are you telling me that Opie,
Opie would be tone-deaf? That was not correct.
You would expect that from Anthony. Maybe not Opie, but it was very, very funny.
Yeah, you're right, but yeah, nonetheless.
Yeah, the Opster.
So,
all right.
Sad story, but the rest of today's news is pretty light. So the, like to plug local-ish kind of stuff going on. So the 28th annual Lucille Ball Comedy Festival is going on in Jamestown, New York, as we speak. Going through the weekend, it was her. She was celebrating her 108th birthday this week as well. Mm-hmm. So
I feel like the only way we're ever going to find out if Brian Ball is actually related to Lucy or not, because he claims he is.
No, he's related to. Wait, no, I'm related to Desi. You're related to Lucy.
We're related. We Ross
can't.
And I are related.
We can't.
He's
have
related
babies.
To Desi Arnaz.
No,
I'm
you're
related
not.
To Ricky.
That's
Jr.
what all Ancestry.com tells me. This
same thing.
It says you're related to Desi Arnaz.
Yeah.
Show me the paper.
I don't. I'll bring it next week.
Okay, where's your paper?
I'll have to find it next week as well, I guess.
Okay, so, and I'm not even.
Are you
kidding.
Doubting my Cuban roots?
Yes. I want to see.
How is this so implausible to you that two people with the same last name from the same general area are related?
Because
how is that implausible to
because
you?
Because talent doesn't
you
skip that many
hair.
Generations, Brian. Okay, that's
no,
why.
My daughter's very talented.
Maybe. But here's what I'm gonna recommend we do, just to see if we could actually prove this. I'm gonna need Ross
gonna
to dress up
DNA.
Like Desi. And Brian, I would need you to dress up like Lucy. And,
hey, wouldn't it be more appropriate if we switched roles?
No.
I was about to say role reversal.
No. Yeah. No. Yeah. I gotta see you as Lucy. I don't buy it.
We're not gonna have to kiss, are we?
I don't think Lucy and Desi actually kissed just like after
I wouldn't
the second
rule it
season.
Out,
just like one of those old-timey TV kisses, you know,
old
where it's sort of
old-timey.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's not like
there's
you have
no
to
tongue.
Push the beds
I mean,
together,
yeah.
Brian, for God's sake.
That's a lot of work.
I'm just saying that I don't believe you, is what I'm saying. I think okay. you're both... Listen, if you're telling me I have the descendants of Lucy and Desi sitting in my studio, and this is the goddamn podcast we have...
It was a very long time ago. And we're very, very, very distantly related. I never said she's like my aunt. Because I'm not getting those checks. Very distantly related.
And I
just want you both to go have cigarettes. Just both of you go smoke.
I don't know how this is implausible to you.
All right, Jamestown Comedy Festival. You're
we both,
love
liars. Lucky Strikes. I don't understand what you're not getting.
I do
yeah,
like Lucky
so,
Strikes.
So Sebastian Mancaluso, John Mulaney are the big headliners, so... They get about 15,000 people, so this is a cool thing. It's probably too late, you know, probably too late to go this year, but something you might want to keep.
Well, considering it's this weekend.
Yeah, something you might want to keep in mind for future times. It's also the anniversary of the comedy center down there. So lots of good stuff going on in Jamestown, New York.
That's great. Lots of great stuff happening at comedy at the Carlson too, Ross.
I mean,
like Joe DeRosa's here.
I mean, if you're in town, sure.
Or if you're what if you're in Wichita?
If you're in Wichita, you're going to want to come here. I mean, the flights are going to be the same.
Yeah.
What are you going to fly to Elmira? Like,
yeah.
What are you going
to
do?
You're going to fly fly here and drive to Jamestown?
Right, right.
Doug, come
yeah.
on, buddy.
So you want to come to
Joe DeRosa.
Okay, so the live from the studio audience thing that they did on ABC a couple months back with...
The Jeffersons?
They did the Jeffersons. They did All in the Family. Sort of a cool thing. I don't know if anybody saw it, but they had like Jamie Foxx and Marissa Tomei and Wanda Sykes and a bunch of fun people. Three Emmys, Norman Lear, as a result, 10 days shy of his 97th birthday, is the oldest Emmy nominee ever for that. And they're going to do...
He's still alive.
He's still alive. He's still gone. He's still producing TV shows. So they're going to do more. They're going to try to do one around Christmas, and they're going to maybe make it an annual event, and they have not announced what other shows or stars they're going
to
do.
Might want to do it sooner than Christmas.
You know what, man? That...
Norman doesn't have a lot of Christmases left.
This Christmas, right?
The ghost of Christmas past is coming for him.
I mean, there's like this generation of like the Betty Whites and the Norman Lears and the Mel Brooks who just see. I mean, I don't want to jinx anybody, so I won't say anything more. But
apparently, the proper ratio of whiskey, steak, and cigarettes will keep you alive. Forever.
Absolutely.
You just got to figure out that magic formula.
Do you think that at some point Norman Lear was just sitting in his mansion? Over the years, just going, I'll tell you what, guys, you'll see. The Jeffersons are going to come back. Just shaking his fist at people.
And it did.
And
look
it did.
Mm-hmm. Look at him.
What a genius.
What a genius.
I hope he wins.
I hope he wins, too. I love him. He's so nice. So, finally.
Can we guess what show they're going to do?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a live studio audience.
I want to see some Maude.
Some Maude?
Yeah.
Like Mary the Tyler Moore the one show? That... Can you do a show where it's actually named after someone who's dead?
See, and I don't know. And what they didn't say for sure, what was unclear was, so Jimmy Kimmel's producing it. I was unclear if this is going to be another Norman Lear thing necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say that specifically. They just said Jimmy Kimmel's doing this. So
or
I don't know
just
if it's like
studio audience show from
open
the 70s.
Up to yeah, but you know, Maude was another Norman Lear show. I think the one where she gets an abortion is the one they should do
for Christmas.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
absolutely.
You're an idiot.
Absolutely.
All right, Desi Jr. What else you got?
Speaking of tone deaf.
Finally, wrapping it up again, keeping this on a lighter note because we sort of sucked up all the energy with the first story. Coming to America 2 is coming out next year. We've been talking about Eddie Murphy, so he is coming back in that. The movie's also going to have Wesley Snipes. They just announced Leslie Jones.
Is he playing Blade in this?
He's playing Blade. Good. Absolutely. It's going to be a crossover.
Does the plot involve him hiding from the IRS?
Oh, that's so mean.
No, it's a fact.
It is. Well,
it's
that
not
is,
mean.
That is a fact. I would totally watch a Coming to America Blade crossover movie. I think that's the cinematic universe that I'd like to see, actually.
I'd like to find a way to actually blend in the Arsenio talk show.
Yeah?
And we are talking perfect.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the story apparently involves Eddie Murphy's character coming back to America because he finds out he's got a child that he didn't know he had. All these people, they haven't announced the roles. It's directed by Hustle and Flow director Craig Brewer, and it's coming sometime later in 2020. So they're taking their time with it, but it should be fun. I like Coming to America.
I
like Leslie Jones. I watch anything with Leslie Jones. So.
Yeah, she's great.
Well, Ross.
Yep.
You escaped another week.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Just barely made it out alive.
Barely made it out alive. Brian, thank you.
Did I also escape another week?
Oh,
can,
no.
Can I come back next week?
No. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Brian's last episode. I'm sorry to let everybody know. Cam, Joe, good job back there, you two. It's been a good episode. Thanks to Joe DeRosa. Go see him this weekend. And for those of you who've made it this far, I'm hoping that's you, Doug, in Wichita. Rate and review. We appreciate it. And we'll be back next week with Thea Vidal. Until then, this is Vinny Paulino saying Brian Ball sucks.
Oh.